WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fundamentalism is changing not only the shape of religion around the world, it's changing politics and culture. In America, fundamentalist Christians are closing down abortion clinics. In Algeria, as fundamentalist Muslims were winning control of parliament, the government cracked down and banned politics in the nation's 10,000 mosques. In Israel, Jewish fundamentalists have been at the forefront of settling the occupied territories. My guest Martin Marty is editing a five-volume series called The Fundamentalism Project, examining the global history of fundamentalism and its social and political impact. Marty is one of America's foremost religion scholars. He's a distinguished professor at the University of Chicago and the author of many books, including the series Modern American Religion. The Fundamentalism Project is part of a program conducted by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Marty says that fundamentalism in America has had a profound effect on Protestantism.
Protestants after World War I were, in a way that you can't even imagine today, quote, running the show. They were running the country. They filled who's who. Their churches made front page news. And then right in the middle of the 20s, they had a split down the middle. One section heading off one way, one the other. So if you want to understand power relations in America, if you want to understand what happened to Protestantism and relation of religion to culture, you have to understand it. But I think that 30 years ago or 40 years ago when I started writing on this topic, most of us thought that fundamentalism had had it. We knew that it still had some radio stations down on the Texas-Mexico border, and we knew that in Tennessee people did very strange things on the other side of the hollow, but most people in the mainline culture dismissed it. And it overtook us. All of a sudden we realized that to the right of the genteel evangelicals like Billy Graham were people who had very threatened and sometimes ominous views of where the world was going, where the culture was going, how to rescue people out of it. And in the 1970s, we learned they had some plans for trying to change the culture.
As someone who appreciates pluralism, how welcoming are you of fundamentalist religions which sometimes don't recognize the validity of other religions or other points of view?
You're right. I do celebrate pluralism, partly because I think it's the only option we have. If we want a society which welcomes immigrants and welcomes personal freedom, and if you have people like me who welcome community and identity and trust and all that, then you have to make room for all kinds of people that you wouldn't naturally feel at home with. So if you ask me, would I like my daughter to marry one? No, I'm nervous about fundamentalists up close. Do I agree with their program? Very seldom. Do I welcome their passion? I do think they have enlivened American life somewhat, but I have to begin on the assumption that the pluralism means any number can play, and even if they would change the rules of the game if they won, so might some other people. I'm very much a devotee of James Madison, and I think that when somebody comes along that you disagree with, you don't rule them out, you counter-organize, and you form new coalitions, and I think that's a much healthier thing for Americans to do than to say, drive them out.
The first volume of your five-volume Fundamentalist Project looks at the rise of fundamentalism around the world, Christians, Jews, Muslims. What are some of the characteristics that you think fundamentalists in different religions have in common?
That's a good question, because some people think that if you do some comparing, you mean that everything is alike, and fundamentalisms are extremely different from each other as far as the content is concerned. Christian doctrine differs from Jewish story, differs from Islamic law. So they're very different. But what do they have in common? They are all modern, dynamic. They're not conservative the way we thought they were. They're not traditional the way we thought they were. The Amish are conservative and Orthodox Jews are traditional, but they're not fundamentalists. Fundamentalists are people who, when they feel threatened by modernity, by change, by pluralism, the word you brought up, by relativism, by strangers and enemies and neighbors that they don't understand, they fight back. And they use things they call fundamentals to fight back. They'll improvise, they'll change these fundamentals constantly to face whatever the threat might be. The threat might be the great Satan of the United States, if you're in parts of the Middle East. It might be secular humanism, if you're an American fundamentalist, but something they're concerned about is going to overwhelm them, they think, unless they fight back.
So you think the fundamentalists aren't traditional or conservative? In fact, they're militant.
We made the mistake of thinking that they were conservative. Conservatives mainly want to be left alone. Traditionalists mainly want to live as if their ancestors were getting the main number of votes, drive past the Amish community, let the Orthodox walk to their temple. They won't hand you a tract. They won't try to convert you. They won't head to the state legislature to try to get a change in the laws. If they violate laws, the ACLU or somebody else has to come along to defend them. They won't even defend themselves. They just want the world to be the way it was with their foreparents. Fundamentalists aren't that. They have the latest techniques. The Ayatollah Khomeini used cassette recorders, and in Egypt they use transistor radios. In America they use television and rapid mails. They want to be in the thick of things, and if they don't like the way things are going, they'll change. Now, you use the word militant, and I suppose that scares some people, because militant in many parts of the world means Sikhs killing Hindus, killing Muslims, killing Jews, or Protestants and Catholics killing each other in Northern Ireland. That's what militant usually means. Militant might just mean highly vocal, highly aggressive. Some of the abortion fronts in America that block clinics and so on are self-described fundamentalists, and they're militant, but I think they just as soon not kill anybody along the way.
Do you think it's any coincidence that fundamentalism within different religions is on the rise?
I don't think it's coincidence so much as common response to common threat. For example, traditionalists and conservatives could be left alone until mass media came. But the moment television can intrude in any Iranian village, the moment U.S. cinema can be shown in Jerusalem on a Friday night of the Sabbath too near the Haredim or some other group that don't want this to happen, they have to respond. So I think the shrinking of the globe is part, the fact that markets bump into each other, the fact of mass media, mass higher education, anything which means that the forces that you don't like can't be kept away is what occasions a fundamentalist response. The other thing that I think that is a very big factor is fundamentalists have good antennae. They read well. They have good instincts. And they sense that certain things that the rest of us try to cope with will overwhelm them. For example, in America, the Roe v. Wade decision on abortion, or the two school prayer decisions of 1962 to 63, they perceived as the government intruding on their way of life, the government allowing the killing of babies, the government pushing God out of the schools. They'll take these kinds of acts, and I think they think that once upon a time they could have been sheltered from them. You could always control your local school. You could always control your local clinic. But now the big forces of bureaucracy and so on are hitting at them. Well, I don't think you have to be a fundamentalist to say that we are much more webbed together and that decisions made at a great distance affect us. So since they feel that, whether in Iran or India or Ireland or anywhere else, they're going to respond the same way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Marty. He's a religion scholar who's editing a 5-volume series called The Fundamentalism Project. The first volume has just been published. American fundamentalists, American Christian fundamentalists, offer themselves as protectors of traditional values in terms of the religion, a family, social values. But isn't the religion really pretty recent, early 20th century, and is that a contradiction?
Well, I think that most fundamentalists choose their past. Other people think they're merely being conservative, so that an American Protestant fundamentalist will tend to choose the biblical period, the time when Jesus is alive, and they'll create a picture of what they thought it was like, and so they'll defend the traditional family in the name of it. Well, one thing you have to say, and I have to say as a believer in the Gospels, the Gospel picture of Jesus is not very close to what today's pro-family people claim. Jesus was quite critical of his mother. His brothers and sisters didn't like him and didn't recognize him. somebody wanted to bury his father, and he said, let the dead bury their own dead. At one time he says, according to the gospel portrait, you have to hate father and mother or for the sake of the kingdom. Now, we all know that's only a little part of the portrait of Jesus, who has the image, or I think rightfully, of being an instrument of love and not of division. But the gospels show him putting the price very high and quite destructive of the kind of family that's here. But the fundamentalists will choose the family from, as your question implied, I think, the late 19th century and say, that's how it always has been. My colleague and associate in this venture, Scott Appleby, is an expert on Roman Catholicism. Roman Catholics who are not exactly fundamentalist, I guess we'd say fundamentalist-like, they're not defending the Bible so much as they're defending the 19th century papacy, infallibility, and things like that.
So when you say that a lot of fundamentalists are really defending 19th century values and offering 19th century values as tradition, is that because that was the set of values that they were most nostalgic for when they started fundamentalism at the turn of the 20th century?
That's very close to it, because at the turn of the 20th century, two kinds of things hit. One, modern technology. They choose the late 19th century, or maybe even the 1920s yet. They have a kind of a Norman Rockwell image of a safe and cozy village America. Was the last possible moment before the change came, and their great-grandparents could still tell them about it. I think that's the one reason. The other reason is some dimensions of modern thought triggered fundamentalism. And here it isn't hard to be empathic with them to understand what a threat it was. In America, in Protestantism, the two threats were evolution, which swept the universities and colleges and academic centers and gave a different accounting of human origins, and biblical criticism, which was just the word for saying that scholars applied scientific tools of history and literary criticism to the Bible the way they would to Shakespeare or Homer or Dante. And the Bible was to be seen in their world as a completely protected book with its own rules of the game. So when those two things came along, technology and these changes in idea patterns, they felt potentially overwhelmed. Everything they stood for would be undercut.
Many fundamentalists reject modernity and reject social change and changes in values. On the other hand, there's parts of modernity that they embrace, like TV. I mean, fundamentalists in America have probably made the best use of broadcasting of any religion. Do you see that as a contradiction?
Again, your questions are right to the target of what we're working on in this project. And that's why I began with what was designed, I think, to be a little upsetting sounding, to say fundamentalists are not fundamental, and they're not historic and traditional conservative. They are modern, but your question has it right. They are selectively modern. On one level, they will pick a presumed past of doctrines, of stories, of laws to go back to. And on the other hand, you're right. Technology is there. It's amazing how worldly a lot of fundamentalists are in America. They want to succeed on general terms. The best known of the fundamentalists, Jerry Falwell, not as well known as he was 12 years ago, but he's still big with his Liberty University in Virginia, always defines it in terms that are, as soon as we're as powerful that we can knock Notre Dame butts on the football field or Mormon butts at Brigham Young, well, these are very worldly ways of counting status and prestige and power. It's kind of a pro-Miss America, pro-National Football League, pro-success kind of thing, which is compatible, in their view, with their doctrines. So you're right. It's a very selective view of what you accept and reject, and this may change from year to year. A few years ago, all fundamentalists said that all rock music was evil because the beat was from Satan. It moved pelvises the wrong way and so on. A few years later, I think some of them, not all of them, but some of them saw their own teenagers being lured, and they come up with Christian rock, which has Jesus' words in it, but it still has the same pelvic beat. I consider them very smart to do that. It's very inconsistent if they were traditionalist.
If you're just joining us, my guest is religion scholar Martin Marty, who's editing a five-volume series called The Fundamentalism Project, and the first volume has just been published. We're going to take a short break, then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the history of fundamentalism, and my guest is religion scholar Martin Marty. Can you explain where the word fundamentalism comes from?
Yes, I can explain it. It comes from a Baptist magazine called Watchman Examiner, where the editor said, everybody wants to be called a conservative, and that doesn't define anybody. We want to be called fundamentalists because we're going to engage in a royal battle for God, or a battle royal, I think was the phrase. He was drawing on several things. The year before, a World's Christian Fundamentalist Association had been organized to fight for fundamentals in the denominations. And between 1910 and 1912, a series of booklets were sent out, paid for by the founders of Union Oil Company, by the way, two lay people, sent to all the Protestant clergy in the country, and they called them the fundamentals. I think if you look in first to 19th century lexicons, concordances, word lists, and indices, you wouldn't find it used that way. It's a 20th century term. And the notion is that in the midst of all of the erosive and corrosive and hurricane-winded forces of the 20th century, there's a rock-bottom foundation of certain basics on which we can build.
Did fundamentalism in America start in the South?
No, fundamentalism in America started in the North, but found its natural congenial home in the South. The South was traditional and conservative. The fundamentalists only took over the Southern Baptist Convention in the last 10 years or so. Southern Baptists were always conservative and traditional, but they weren't reactive and they weren't trying to pass laws for the whole country the same way. No, it was born at Niagara-on-the-Lake in Ontario. It was born in Dwight Moody's Chicago. It was born in Riley's Minneapolis. It was born in New York, in Toronto. Only one, a man named J. Frank Norris of Fort Worth, among the top 10 or 15 founders was a Southerner. But in the North, they didn't win as much. More secular people, more liberal people, people who rejected the cultural context tended to repudiate them, and it remained a rather definable club. And then as the years passed and sudden change came to the South, when Dixie became Sunbelt, tradition and conservatism became fundamentalism. So when people look at the Bible Belt, as H.L. Mencken was defining it already in the 20s, it had a natural predisposition to it. But the formal techniques and the definitions of fundamentalism in the overwhelming sense that we see them today in groups like the Southern Baptist Convention, that's a more recent move.
Do you see fundamentalism in the 90s in America headed in any different directions than it was in the 80s or the 70s?
Partly by conscious strategy, partly by instinct, I see great differences. I do have two images that I find that our readers and our audiences pick up pretty quickly, and they're both shaped the same way. One is the wedge with a sharp point of aggression, and the other is the beam with an originating point of light. Now let me say what I mean by them. The wedge, that's 1976. They tried it with Jimmy Carter, and he didn't satisfy them. They tried it with Mr. Reagan, and they got a good deal more. They tried it through much of the 80s. That is, they had some point men. They had some very well-known people. They had celebrities that you could put on magazine covers and everybody knew. They had some clergy and lay people, televangelists and politicians that formed a kind of a probing and pushing front. The tactic is, if we can have a congenial White House, if we can get some constitutional amendments, if we can win the Supreme Court, if we can get the state legislatures on our side, then we will have our way, and in effect we can remake America and we can run America. Through the years, I think they learned a lot of things. There were disappointments. They didn't get as much from Mr. Reagan, and they get even less from Mr. Bush as far as the formal program is concerned. They won a lot of things on the Supreme Court, but they can't trust the court to do everything. The legislatures are highly mixed. Economic questions often dominate. So it doesn't work, and there were some very prominent mistakes they made, and some celebrities fell. The strategy doesn't work. Nobody's going to run America. The Catholic bishops don't run it, and the Jews don't run it, and the African-American churches that elect northern mayors don't run it, and certainly mainstream Protestants don't run it, and the Mormons don't run it. They're all players in the game. And so with some instinct, I think the fundamentalists have perceived that the battle is located somewhere else. The things that matter most to them, the intimate things of life, marriage, sex, gender, generational things, public schools, hospitals are it. And now, therefore, we have less well-known people, not less motivated, not fewer in number, not less gifted, but less of a celebrity sort, who have a whole network of organizations to try to assure that we get textbooks that only they have approved, that we see films that only they have liked. The attack now would be on the NEA and the National Endowment for the Humanities, National Endowment for the Arts, but most of all, it's local. It'll be a textbook battle, and the mass media have a little more trouble keeping their eye on it, because a textbook battle in Warsaw, Indiana, and a library board battle in Shreveport, Louisiana, and a clinic battle in Wichita, they don't seem to be connected. And I don't have a conspiracy theory. It isn't that the fundamentalists sit down and have it all that plotted. But I think they have an instinct to say the influence we're going to have is going to be in the shape of the beam of light. From this originating source, we'll let that light fall on many other parts of society, and we'll win more that way.
The American Academy of Arts and Sciences asked you to do the five-volume fundamentalism project. They're interested in finding out what implications there will be of fundamentalism for public policy formulation. I'm wondering if you have any ideas of how the history of fundamentalism and the resurgence of fundamentalism might affect public policy.
Well, I have many kinds of ideas. We ourselves, as scholars, don't take sides in any of these things. But it would be, I think, very foolish for people not to pay attention to the military implications of fundamentalism, the economic, dealing with parts of the world where Islam, in its fundamentalist form, has influence on economy, is going to affect American economy, and domestically, public policy implications. I always tell people my main public policy implication is to make a great deal of James Madison and the U.S. Constitution and the Federalist Papers, namely, keep our pluralism rich and alive. Don't go reaching for laws that say, let's rule out the fundamentalists, but get our own acts together, if we don't agree with them, to head them off. I think that such groups have made some gains. I think fundamentalists were getting a free ride in some of the courts and some of the textbook publishing world. With some of their programs a dozen years ago, and they find it somewhat harder now. Some reviews of our book, I think, in effect, will say, of all of our books, will say, you scholars are so fair to the fundamentalists, or fair-minded, or empathic, I used that word a couple times, or whatever, that you make them all sound so nice that we'll all go to sleep. Some fundamentalists read it and say, you're alarmist. I guess as long as it comes from both those directions, we'll have a sense that we are presenting materials that will be useful to the very broad parts of the culture.
Well, Martin Marty, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoyed the opportunity. Thank you.
Martin Marty is editing the five-volume series, The Fundamentalism Project. The first volume has just been published by the University of Chicago Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.